God has granted us with another week of life, and let's use at least part of this day doing some Bible study in His inspired Word. We're going to open our Bibles to Revelation chapter 19. We're going to start at verse 11 in a moment, because now we are ready to talk about the Battle of Harmageddon. Now, first things first, you already know, if you've been here for several sessions, that I don't believe this battle takes place or even starts at the city of Megiddo, which is 60 miles north and a little bit west of the city of Jerusalem. I think every indication is that the events related to the climactic battle we're about to read about happen at Jerusalem. And so I am convinced that the word that John uses, and he's the only one that uses it in the New Testament, Harmageddon, with the N on the end, means Har, hill or mountain, Mageddon, which is a participle that appears in the book of Zechariah, chapter number 14, and it means cutting. I think Harmageddon is cutting mountain or split mountain, and it is a reference to an event described again in the book of Zechariah there in chapter number 12, where the Mount of Olives splits in the middle along a dividing line east to west. The mountain itself moves north and south, and makes a brand new valley that goes from the city of Jerusalem toward the Dead Sea Valley. And eventually, the river of the water of life is going to flow through this new valley. But for our purposes, after the city of Jerusalem is overrun by the beast leader's forces, and the two witnesses are killed, and then they're resurrected 3.5 days later, and an earthquake takes place at Jerusalem about 10 days before Jesus arrives with the last trumpet. That, I believe, is when the valley opens up. And then the beast leader gathers his forces to the city of Jerusalem, the remaining people in his kingdom, to Jerusalem, and he positions a bunch of them right there in this new valley to stop Jesus from fulfilling prophecy of arriving back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords at the Mount of Olives. It just so happens that the day I'm recording this, it is Ascension Day 2024. And we know that when Jesus ascended from heaven, or ascended back into heaven from earth 40 days after his resurrection, that the two angels who appeared to the apostles later said, "Men of Galilee, why are you looking up into the sky after this Jesus? This same Jesus whom you saw go away will come back in like manner." And that is a prophecy about Jesus' second coming being targeted back at the Mount of Olives, back at the Jerusalem area, back at the Middle East. And so I believe that is where the Battle of Split Mountain, Harmageddon, takes place. Now let's describe the arrival of Jesus from the sky to planet Earth in pursuit of touchdown on the place that belongs to Him. And by this time, by my estimation, about 10 days have passed since Jesus' second coming. Last session we talked about how some of that time is probably used up as the feast of the Lamb, the wedding feast of the Lamb, all of the resurrected and transformed saints being together and enjoying Jesus' presence, maybe even a little bit of an awards ceremony, if you will, during this time. But I am convinced that there is great symbolism in the 10th day of the 7th month being Yom Kippur, being the day on which those who won't be redeemed by the blood of the Lamb will die for their sins. And so that's why I believe that that is likely to be the chronology that we're following right here. Let's read the text now. Revelation 19:11. Then I, and remember this is John the Apostle, writing from the middle of the 90s of the first century. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. Now for the Roman era readers of the book of Revelation, that was a pretty big deal because the conquering general rode a white horse in his triumphal parade. And so there may be a little bit of that imagery there, but as you've heard me say many times, I am a literalist in most cases. And so I really do believe Jesus will be arriving for the Battle of Armageddon on a white horse. And if he's in the sky, it must be a flying white horse, which I love. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True. So those are two of his describing attributes. He can be trusted, and he is genuine. In righteousness, he judges and makes war. And so we don't want to miss that second aspect of what's said here. He is coming back to wage war. Against who? The remnant of those that have taken the mark of the beast. They are in direct rebellion against him. Remember at the very beginning of the wrath time, God sent out angels that warned everybody they needed to worship the real God and not take the mark of the beast. If they took the mark of the beast, they were done. They can't come back from that. And so Jesus has already punished them severely in the seven wrath events. The sixth wrath event took out a third of the remaining population of the world, which is an immense number that must have come from the ranks of those that took the mark of the beast. And so the only ones that are left in all of the beast leader's kingdom have apparently gathered here together to the Jerusalem region, concentrating especially on what used to be the Mount of Olives in the valley of Split Mountain, trying to deny Jesus entry back to planet Earth. And Jesus will prosecute a final war against them. And he will be fair. Verse number 12, a description from chapter number 1. His eyes are like a flame of fire. So he is this energetic, dynamic, piercing figure that sees to the very heart of each of these people, and that's how he will judge them. His eyes are like a flame of fire. On his head are many diadems. Now, diadems are royal crowns. In the first century world, they were often just like a ribbon. Sometimes it was a silver ribbon or a golden ribbon, or maybe it was embroidered with silver or gold in it. Sometimes it actually was some sort of metal circlet that went around the head. So this is not the victor's crown, this is the kingly crown. And Jesus doesn't just have one, he has all of them. They belong to him. and he has a name written that no one knows but himself. Now that is interesting. It goes back to something we read in the Overcomer promises in the letters that Jesus was dictating to the seven churches of Asia province. And in chapter 2, verse number 17, he said, "To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna." So that's the manna that was stored in the seat of the Ark of the Covenant, one day's ration. And I believe that God will literally feed us from that manna, just like Jesus fed the 5,000 with a few fish and loaves of bread. I think Jesus will feed us all from that manna. But he will also give to him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it. And so this is like a pet name. This is a secret name. This is an intimate name that Jesus has with us, and apparently God the Father has with him. He has a name that only he knows. And then we have a description of his clothing at this time. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood. And I have already suggested to you that the word dipped here might be better understood as spattered. Because over in Isaiah chapter 63, the prophet living in the 8th century B.C. Says this prophetically. He says, this is chapter 63, starting at verse 1 of Isaiah. "Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozrah, with red garments, this one clothed gloriously with great strength?" And so the prophet sees somebody coming toward Jerusalem, apparently, from the south, from the region to the south and a little bit west of the Dead Sea. And he's clothed in amazing clothing, but they're red. And then the response is, "I am the one declaring righteousness and judgments of salvation." And that matches exactly what we just read here in Revelation, that he is judging in righteousness and waging war. Isaiah then asks the question, verse 2, "Why are your garments red?" The response, "I am treading the wine vat alone. There is not a man from the nations with me. I trod them in my fury and trampled them in wrath. Their blood spattered on my clothes, and all my garments were defiled. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redemption has arrived." And so I parallel that passage from Isaiah 63 to this passage here, that was actually Jesus prophetically seen by Isaiah at this time where he is arriving at Jerusalem from the south region, where I suggested to you that he may have already avenged the blood of some of his martyrs when they had escaped from Jerusalem a few days earlier from the city of Jerusalem's overrun, and they escape through the New Valley and maybe hang a right when they get down into the Dead Sea Valley and head toward Edom. And so here in Revelation 19, Jesus has a red spattered robe, and his name by which he is called is the Word of God. And John, of course, is the one who writes those very famous words at the beginning of his gospel. "In the beginning was the Word." And it's clearly a reference to Jesus. And so if there was any doubt up to verse 13, there's no doubt now. This is Jesus on the white horse. Verse 14, this is us, folks. "These are the redeemed, the armies of heaven, arrayed in white linen, which we've seen in other places, that they are kind of robed in white, and the white represents the righteous acts of the saints. But they are arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, and they were following him on white horses. So a couple of things. I actually was sharing this with a bunch of elementary school age kids yesterday in chapel, and I was kind of celebrating a one day ahead of time, Ascension Day. And I always like to kind of get a little excitement going in the hearts of kids. And I said, if these horses are up in the sky with Jesus, what does that mean? And of course, the answer is, they must be flying horses. And if we're on these flying horses, then maybe we ought to get a name ready for our flying horse. And so I kind of just tongue-in-cheek, a little bit of smile, a little bit of fun here, that this is us in Jesus' entourage on the day of the Battle of Harmageddon. But it doesn't appear as if his entourage need to do anything. Jesus is the one that meets out judgment. Verse 15, from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. And we saw that imagery back in the beginning of the book of Revelation. And he will rule them with a rod of iron. Now, we will eventually come back to that. Actually, let's go ahead and do that now. I think that'd be good. This is a passage of Scripture that makes reference to Psalm number 2. And it is a description of Jesus. And there's a little bit of a debate in scholarly circles about the proper word here in Psalm 2. And I think reading its allusion or its quotation here in Revelation 19 helps answer that issue. But let's get the full context of Psalm 2 by reading from it. It's clearly a messianic song, and it goes like this. Why are the nations, the ethnic groups outside of Israel, in an uproar, and the people devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against he who is, and against his Mashiach, his Messiah, his anointed one, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. Now, this psalm, this part of it, is quoted in the New Testament book of Acts as a reference to how the Gentiles, as in the Romans, as in Pontius Pilate, had kind of stood up against Jesus and been involved in his execution at his first coming. But I think it goes beyond that in its prophetic import because it also matches what might be going on in the minds of the beast leader and his followers, where they're standing against he who is, against the return of the Mashiach, the Messiah. And what are they saying? Let's rip these chains away from us. Let's not let them enslave us. And what does God do in return? Verse 4 of Psalm 2. He who sits in the heavens laughs. And this is a derisive laugh. It's a scornful laugh. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. So God basically says, I'm still going to install Jesus as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Doesn't matter what you try to do. Verse 7, I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. today I have begotten you. So this is God the Father speaking to God the Son. It is not that Jesus is coming into existence. What this is a declaration of paternity. You are definitely my son. You are the one that I declare to be my heir today, the one that runs my entire household and all of my affairs. That's the declaration that's coming out here. And God the Father, of course, said this on several occasions during Jesus' ministry, the first of which seems to be at his immersion. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased, right? Now, back to where God the Father is talking to God the Son here. Verse 8, ask of me, and I will surely give the nations, that is, the ethnic groups, as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. So God the Father says to God the Son, just ask, and I'm going to give you a kingdom over all the ethnic groups that are out there. You will be in charge of the entirety of the earth. And then comes the place that's quoted in Revelation 19, 15. You will, and I'm actually looking at a New American Standard right now, break them with a rod of iron. That's similar to what we see in other English passages at this point. And the reason that they go with that is because they look at the Hebrew here and assume that the word that they're reading is ra'ah. And I disagree. And so did the first translators from Hebrew to Greek, the writers of the Septuagint in the 3rd century B.C., men who were professional students in the Word of God in both Hebrew, and they also grew up being able to speak and write Greek. And what they wrote in the text here is exactly what we see in Revelation 19:15. You will rule them or shepherd them with a rod of iron. Because the word for shepherd is similar to the word for break or shatter. It is ra'ah. It's just one single letter off. And the different forms of the verbs sometimes miss out on that distinction. So I think that verse 9 of Psalm 2 should read, you shall shepherd them with a rod of iron. You will shatter them like earthenware. And this is going to be the first of our citations, shall we say, about what's going to happen in the millennium. For those who are not yet the redeemed, the mortals who go into the millennium, whom the Lord is going to rule over as a shepherd, but he's going to do it strongly and expect them to toe the line and expect them to eventually make up their mind. We'll talk more about that later. But that's all Psalm 2 that I really want to talk about right now, because we got to the place that explains Revelation 19:15 well. He will rule them with a rod of iron, Revelation 19:15 says. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. So he's going to start with a war against those who have taken the mark of the beast, going to get them out of the way, and then he will deal with all of those who are in the in-between status. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, those that took the mark of the beast voluntarily are lost. They have no other choice. That was the end of their choices. those who have been resurrected and transformed and caught up together to meet the Lord in the air, the ones that are riding on the horses behind Jesus on this particular day, they've already been redeemed because they made their minds up. But there are plenty of others, both in the day of the Lord and perhaps, as I will suggest, in times past, that never really had a clear-cut ability to make a free will choice one way or the other about Jesus. And so they're the ones that are going to be in the millennium as mortals. And their purpose during the 1,000 years is to make their mind up. But we'll save that for a later time. Verse number 16 in Revelation 19. On his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written. Apparently, there's writing on his clothing. Some people have pictured him wearing some sort of banner, like you see pageant winners wearing. That name is a name we've heard a lot already. King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It's an old Persian phrase. High King is the idea. He is the top of everyone that has ever been in charge. And so that is Jesus arriving for the Battle of Armageddon. And what happens next is another feast invitation. Now, last session, we talked about the blessings that were upon those invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. Well, that's already happened. That happened after Jesus came back, and we all were transformed or resurrected and went up to join him in the sky. This time, an invitation goes out to the birds of the air saying, there's about to be a big battle. You all need to be on standby to clean up the battlefield afterward.